Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
First of all, welcome tonight to the Tattered Cover Bookstore, and thank you for coming out and supporting those local and independent businesses in your community, because it really does make a difference. Since everybody here is clearly fans of Walt Longfire, Sheriff of Wyoming, and certainly has either read about his adventures or seen them on the small screen, I'm just going to get out of the way. Just to welcome Craig for the 13th installment. Please help me welcome Craig Johnson.
Thank you. Well, it is wonderful to be here like that, and I guess, you know, it is always like a big event here, like it to be at the Tattered Cover. And this is a little bit, you know, I want to do a little bit of a pre-thing here. I'm using a bookmark here that's a blue beaded bookmark like that I actually gave to my mother a number of years ago. Like that, and I don't know if a lot of you may not be aware like that, but my mother passed away just last month like that. And so I just wanted to be clear and honest with you and tell you that you are seeing tonight the second best storyteller in the Johnson family. My mother was always the very best storyteller that there was, and as proof of that, I'm going to tell you a quick story that I actually sent out as a post-it a couple of years back. One of the things that my wife always says about my family is that we have no shame, you know, that we always, you know, whatever it is, like we just say it what it is, like we tell everybody about it, you know, we don't hide anything. And as an example of that, like my mother, one of my favorite stories, my mother called me up on the phone one day and told me this story. And what had happened was is that she had actually gone to my nephew's apartment where he was going to college, and she would always gather up his laundry and do it, and she would always, you know, put groceries in his grocery, into his refrigerator and everything. And so she got there, like, and of course, you know, the towels were all had, you know, mold on them, like the sheets were gray, you know, all the moms in the audience are shaking their heads, yeah. And so anyway, she gathered up all the laundry after she put the groceries in, like, and she took them home, did the laundry, like, and, you know, and later on she brought it back, like, and she folded it up and she had it sitting on a chair right beside the door. And she was getting ready to go out the door, and she thought to herself, you know what, I'm going to come back next month and these sheets and towels are going to be folded up and sitting on the chair by the door, like it, so I might as well go ahead and just trade them out, like it. And so she went and put the, you know, the towels and hung them all up, like it. And she made the bed, and she was making the bed, and she was putting the fitted sheet on the mattress, like it. And she was having trouble, she couldn't get the last corner on the fitted sheet, like it. And so she reaches up in the corner and pulls out, and then there was a pair of women's panties is what it was. And she's like, that little rat, like, I'm going to teach him a lesson, like, and so she takes the panties and she hangs them on the mirror of his dresser, like that, and then, you know, goes home. And I swear she, like, sat on the phone waiting, you know. About 10 o'clock that night, phone rings, like, at my nephew calls her and says, you know, hey, you know, grandma, how you doing, like, and she goes, I'm fine. Did you like that little present that I left for you? And there was a long pause, and he says, Mama, why did you hang your underwear on my mirror? So she tries to brave it out, right? So she says, why don't you think that's my underwear? And his response was, well, the girls that I date don't wear that six cotton panty, I'm expecting an assassination attempt underwear. And so it wasn't like, you know, she didn't get off the phone with him for like 10 minutes before she calls me up on the phone, like, and starts telling me all about it, like, and I'm dying laughing, falling off the sofa, like, and finally my wife was asking, what is wrong? And I finally just handed her the phone. I said, you got to hear this from the horse's mouth. There's no way I'm going to, you know, try and tell that story all over again. But she was a pretty marvelous woman and a wonderful storyteller in her own right, like that. But she didn't get a chance to read this book, I'm sorry to say, like that, because this is a fun one, I have to say, that. Most of the books that I write, you know, generally, you guys know the story that the most of them tend to come from newspaper articles, you know, from up in Wyoming, Montana, here in Colorado. Like, whenever I'm traveling around, I go to a small town, I always snag up, you know, a local paper, and I always end up, you know, cutting them out, you know, and putting them in a file folder and keeping them for later. That's that plot part that I'm always, you know, working on as far as the books are concerned. And this one was a little bit different. You know, it kind of came about a little bit differently. And what happened with it was, is that the books have been translated into a number of languages. Like, and as a matter of fact, fact, we were just translated into British, our most difficult translation so far. And we were over in London like that. And one of the things that happens whenever we go on some of these foreign trips is sometimes, you know, our daughter and granddaughter glom onto us. Suddenly we're much more, you know, worthy of being traveled with like that whenever we're going abroad. Like that. And so we're in London like that. And I'm with my 6-year-old granddaughter and we're walking around. And mostly what my job is, you know, whenever we're on these trips is to look at her every 10 minutes and go, you know, when I was your age, I didn't get to go to London. You know, when I was your age. I didn't get suitcases full of clothes brought back from Paris, just so you know. So I'm sure she's by the time she's 14, she's going to have a shirt that says, you know, when I was your age. Okay. But anyway, like we happen to go into the Museum of Natural History there in London, and we go in, and they've got a great big T-Rex, you know, display, you know, big huge one. Like, we walk in, I'm looking at it; it's really impressive. And I look down, and there's a plaque at the bottom of it that says, you know, Niobrara County, Wyoming. And I was like, geez, you know, they shipped our, you know, dinosaur all the way over here like that, you know. And so then, you know, I think it was like maybe about, you know, 6 months later, we happened to be in Paris, you know, when we were there at Museum of Natural History, and I walked in, there was another T-Rex, and it was from Wyoming, too. And so I asked a buddy of mine, a paleontologist, like, and I said, what's the story on this? And he goes, well, yeah, the majority of the T-Rexes that populate the majority of the museums in the world all come from, you know, pretty much the northern Rocky region. Like, and he says, and a lot of them come from that Powder River area, you know, there in Wyoming. Like, and I thought that was kind of interesting. And so I started doing a little bit more research on it, you know, trying to learn a little bit more about it. And, you know, one of the stories that really kind of hit and hit hard was the one about Sioux, the one up there with the Black Hills Institute, like that, which resulted in, you know, Peter Larson, like that, one of the founders of the Black Hills Institute, actually spending 2 years in prison here in Colorado, which I think was extraordinarily unfair like that. But what had happened was they had found this T-Rex. They had discovered this T-Rex on this rancher's property, and they had a contract with that rancher that they would pay him a certain amount of money for each find that they made, and so they paid him the money like that, and then they unearthed this thing and they discovered it was the largest, most intact T-Rex ever found like that. Well, he suddenly figured out that it was worth a little bit more than what that they had said that they were going to pay him like that, and so he sued them to try and get a higher price for it and to regain ownership of Sue like that. Well, the problem with that was is that he was an Indian rancher, and the tribe stepped in and said, you know what, it's not just yours, it's actually ours. And it was about then that the federal government did plotting, GPS plotting on it, and discovered that it was actually discovered on lease property from the federal government. So the federal government sent the FBI in, and they said, you know what, it's not just yours, it's all of ours. Okay. Well, this led to like a court case that went on for years is what happened like that. And the final result was that Sue ended up going to auction in Sotheby's in New York and was sold for $8.2, I think close to $8 million, I think it was. She was actually sold to the Field Museum in Chicago. And it's kind of interesting like that, because when you go into the main hall there in Chicago and look, okay, there's a mastodon that's in the front of the hallway there. And just over the mastodon's back, you see this T-Rex turning and it's looking at the front door like, what's for lunch, you know? And the underwriters for that particular purchase were two corporations, McDonald's and Walt Disney. They were the ones that provided the millions like to buy that T-Rex. And one of the motivating factors was that there was a Dubai sheik that wanted to buy the T-Rex and put it in the entryway of his house. And McDonald's and Walt Disney said, nah, that ain't gonna happen. Like, and so that's how it all kind of came to be. Like, and so I thought, you know what, that sounded like a Walt Longmire mystery is what it sounded like, you know? And so what I'm going to do here is I'm going to do a little bit of a reading here for you. Like, I know I don't normally do a little bit of a reading, but this is a relatively short one, and I thought you might enjoy it. So you get to watch me put my reading glasses on, which is always fun to watch. Like, and so here we go. All right. So this is from the very first chapter of Dry Bones. She was close to 30 years old when she was killed. A big girl, she liked to carouse with the boys at the local watering holes, which, of course, led to a lot of illegitimate children. But by all accounts, she was a pretty good single parent and could take care of herself and her brood. One night, though, a gang must have jumped her. They were all younger than she was, and they had numbers. They might have even been family. But after they'd broken her leg and she was on the ground, it was pretty much over. There was no funeral. They killed her and left what was remained there by the water, where the sediment from the forgotten creek built up around her, layer by layer, compressing and compacting her to the point where the bones leached away and were replaced by minerals. It was almost as if she'd been turned to stone just to keep from being forgotten. It's interesting how her remains were found. Her namesake, Jennifer Watt, was traveling with Dave Bauman, the director of the High Plains Dinosaur Museum, when they got a flat. Not an unusual occurrence on the red roads the ranchers used for the more inaccessible areas of their ranches, and where the larger chunks of shale attack sidewalls like tomahawks. The bigger rock is cheaper, but it's also the size of bricks and has a lot of sharp edges, edges that like to make meals of anything less than 10-ply. Dave had been trying to squeak another season out on the tires of the 67 Land Rover, but there they stood, staring at a right rear with a distinct lack of round, in the middle of the Lone Elk Ranch. While he fished the jack and spare from the hood and began the arduous task of replacing the tire, Jennifer unloaded Brody, her Tibetan Mastiff, and went for a walk, hoping to meet a friend on the place. She followed a ridge around a cornice, but the dog, who was weighed 150 pounds with a heavy coat, began panting. And before long, Jen decided that it might be a pretty good idea for the two of them to try and get some shade. Not an easy proposition on the Powder River country. Luckily, there was a rock overhang along the ridge, plenty enough room for her and the dog to get in out of the late afternoon sun. She wore her blonde hair in a ponytail that stuck through the adjustment strap of her hole-in-the-wall bar ball cap, and pulling the collapsible dog bowl from her pack, she slipped out a Nalgene bottle, took a swig, and then poured the Mastiff a drink. Jennifer looked out on the grass that undulated like a gigantic rolling sea, and it was easy to imagine the western interior Cretaceous Seaway or the Niobraran Sea that had once covered this land, splitting the continent of North America into two land masses, Laramidia to the west and Appalachia to the east. The Great Sea had stretched from Mexico to the Arctic and had been over 2,000 feet deep. Jen settled under the rock and petted her dog, her green eyes scanning the landscape. She pulled her video camera from her pack and panned the distance, seeing things out there on the high plains, things that didn't exist, at least not anymore. Predatory marine reptiles like long-necked plesiosaurs and more alligator-like mosasaurs, almost 80 feet long. When she'd been six, her father had brought her to this country from Tucson, Arizona, and had dragged her along on his private excavations that helped support his rock shop on the old highway out near Lake Desmet between Durant and Sheridan. She still remembered that she'd said one day as they'd gotten out of his battered pickup, her fingers climbing up his pant leg until she found the reassuring hand with gloves worn like saddle leather, the adjustment straps with the transparent red beads. "There's nothing out here, Daddy." He surveyed the rolling hills that led from the Bighorn Mountains and into the endless Powder River country, smiling as he pushed back his straw hat and spoke gently to her. "There's everything here. You just have to know where to look." Jennifer had learned to look and had never stopped. Dave Bauman's hands and hers were in every excavation that had led to the displays that crowded the High Plains Dinosaur Museum in Durand. And at 26, she was still searching. Truth to be told, Jen liked dead things better than she liked live ones. They were less trouble, and the conversations being one-sided. A lot of investigators and paleontologists are more comfortable that way, able to accept the onslaught of truth, disparaging the absolute as something that always carries the danger of being overturned by some new and extraordinary piece of evidence. She lowered the camera, took another sip of her water, and poured her dog more. Brody sighed and shook his massive head, and Jen leaned back under the rock overcropping to try and decide what it was she was going to do with the old man's rock shop, a ramshackle affair near the lake that had started out as a trailer, but through the years it evolved into a labyrinth of wooden fences lined with geodes, gems, quartz, and rock samples, most of them worthless. He had died the year before, and she knew the land was more valuable than the structure itself, but she'd grown up there, and loved the old place, as cluttered and tacky as it might be. She pulled the cap over her eyes and dozed until she became aware of a protracted growl in her dog's throat. She swatted at him, but he continued to rumble, a warning, until she finally lifted the bill of her cap to look at him. He was looking directly up. Jen's eyes followed his to where a two-fingered talon stretched out of the rock ceiling down towards her, almost as if imploring. She grabbed the camera and began to film what would become one of the greatest paleontological discoveries of modern times. Now, Now, that's all very prosaic, like that, but this is a murder mystery. And, of course, what happens next is that I have to tell you, like, at the beginning story of this book, you know, a lot of the stories that I use, like, are ones from old sheriffs, like, and the one that starts this particular book was one from the grandson of a Wyoming sheriff. And what actually happened was is that he was getting ready to go out and to go fishing with his grandfather, who was the sheriff, like that, and they were on their way out, like that, and all of a sudden the grandfather got a phone, you know, not a phone call, but rather a radio call, like that, to come out to a reservoir. And so he looked at his 5-6-year-old, you know, grandson and said, well, do you mind if we answer that? You know, and the 6-year-old kid said, yeah, sure. I mean, it was his first case. Of course, he's going to say yes. Like, and so finally get to see what his grandfather does, like, for a living. Like, and so they drive out there, like, and they get there, and there was a deputy standing by the reservoir, and he's holding a handful of rocks, like, and they pull up, like, and he's tossing the rocks into the water. And, you know, the grandson says, is that some kind of strange fishing technique I don't know about, Grandpa? Like, and he goes, well, no, I don't think so. Let's go find out. Like, and they get out, and the sheriff looks at the deputy. He says, Paul, what are you doing? Like, and he says, I'm trying to throw these rocks, trying to keep those snapping turtles off that dead body floating out there in the water. So, and that's how we start. Like, and so, anyway, like, and I hope you'll enjoy Dry Bones. Like, at this point in time, what I'd like to do is open it up and let you guys ask some questions. I know we already did a few already, like that, but if you've got a few left, I'm more than happy to entertain those. Yes, sir.
Are you a hermit?
Part of the year, yeah, I am, I have to admit. I mean, it's a balance, you know, because it's kind of a strange thing that they do with authors like that, because, I mean, in all reality, what I do is, like, hide in my room and, you know, and type about my imaginary friends, you know, and if you guys were smart, you'd just lock the door and never let us out is what you do. Like, but then, you know, every once in a year, like that, they have us out like a dog and pony show and send you out on the road like that for about a month, you know, to just go out, like, and meet people and talk with them and everything. And I got to admit, I kind of enjoy both. I really do like it. I mean, I enjoy the isolation, you know. If I didn't, I wouldn't live on a ranch where the nearest town has a population of 25. You know, but so I like that. You know, I enjoy the isolation. I enjoy, you know, being in Walt's world and all of that. But then again, I really enjoy going out on the book tours and meeting the people who read my books. That for me is a real joy. I mean, I'm always thinking about all the authors who never got the chance to do that. And, you know, for me, it's kind of wonderful. I mean, I'm getting emails now from people who've already finished the book in one day like that, you know, and I'm answering those like that dutifully like that. And it's a joy for me, I have to admit, you know. Anybody else? Anybody else got a question? Yes, ma'am. They film for like about 4 months is what they do. Look at, and so it's kind of a process. It's kind of like maneuvers of the Eighth Army to a certain extent, you know, because I mean, they get going like, and it takes them about like a week, a little more than a week and a half, you know, for each episode. And Longmire's a little tough like that because an awful lot of the show takes place out of doors. And that complicates matters like that, you know, even if you're filming in, you know, a relatively weather stable environment like New Mexico, as opposed to Wyoming, then, you know, it's a little bit, and they start filming like in March, you know, and go through all the way through June like that. And so it's a pretty long, you know, filming schedule that they have like that. And it's kind of wonderful that we have the quality of actors that we do that are willing to put that kind of part of their life, you know, aside like that and do that for that length of time. It's kind of nice. So somebody else had their hand up. Yes, ma'am. Oh yeah, absolutely. Like, and boy, is that fun to talk with the translators. Like, to try and like get them to understand, you know, what it is that I meant by it. You know, one of them was really hard. Was there's a part in one of the earlier books where Walt refers to somebody as a hand, and man, it took me forever to get the French to understand that phrase. Like, and so, you know, there are always going to be those. Like, and I'll hear one, you know, that I'll write down real quick. You know, like what was the one that I heard just the other day? You know, blind as a bald face owl on a high moon. Like. I think I heard that one the other day, and I was like, I wrote that one down. I was like, I got to use that. So Walt doesn't use those all that much, but Lucian does. Lucian uses them almost all the time, like it's almost to the point where nobody understands anything he's saying practically. Like, and so that's kind of fun for me because each, you know, voice, you know, in a book is kind of like, you know, when you write a book, it's something like a conducting a choir, and each one of those voices is going to provide, you know, a certain, you know, voice for the book. Like, and so you've got to, you know, arrange that, you know, before you get started on the book. And so, you know, for me, that's always been one of the great joys of the, you know, of the writing process is like, you know, and every once in a while like that, you know, I'll write a line. And I'm like, no, that's not the kind of voice that that character has and not the kind of words that that character would use. And I have to swap things around a little bit if I still have some of the others in the room there. So, yes, ma'am. I cannot believe how unfaithful some of those actors are. He's got a new baby, like that, so he's got to work, like, you know. And so he, even when you got 8 months off a year, like that, you got to get your butt out there and hustle, like, and so. But I do feel like that because I mean, I think I saw Adam Bartley was on Justified. And I was like, what the heck is he doing over there? You know, you do. You feel like they're cheating on you or something like that. So, and that ain't right. You know, do what now? You know what? You look like you might be one of the spies from Warner Brothers who made me sign one of those, you know, non-disclosure contracts where I would not give away any plot points. And that was very clever the way you kind of sidled up to it there to ask that question like that. But I, some people call me stupid, but I think that they're overestimating me like that. But, I'm not going to answer that question. Like, you can ask a question, but it better not be the same one. So,
I just wondered if Longmire days are still going.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Longmire days are going strong. Okay, and we're going to have quite a crew up there this year. Like, for those of you who don't know, like that, we have what we call Longmire days in Buffalo, Wyoming, a little town of about 4,000 people, bound down on the base of the Bighorn Mountains, and it's kind of the basis for Durant in the books. Like that, and pretty much all the cast from Longmire comes up, and it's a zoo. I got to tell you, it's like 12,000 people show up for it and everything like that, and it's really kind of funny like that because it's not, you know, the way a lot of these things are done nowadays. It's kind of like an old school kind of event because, you know, it's not unusual for you to see, you know, Robert, the guy that plays the sheriff, Robert Taylor, standing out in front of the Occidental Hotel during the barn during the street dance, drinking a beer and just talking with people and stuff. And so it's very accessible, which is kind of nice like that. One of the funny things that happened whenever we had the first Longmire days and they came up, Robert wanted to go into town and take a look around and see a little bit of things before, you know, the onslaught of all the people showed up and get the lay of the land. I brought him in, dropped him off, and then, you know, went to the, you know, hardware store and went to the bank and stuff, came back around and pulled up like, and he's sitting there on a bench in front of the Busy Bee Cafe, which really does exist, like, and he's sitting there talking to some old rancher, and he sees me and he comes over and he climbs in the truck, and I said, well, did you see somebody you knew, like, and he goes, no, he says a rancher from over in Claremont, and he said he came in because he wanted to see if he could spot some of those movie stars from the TV show, and I told him me too. You know, we didn't have his hat on and his coat and his badge, you know, I guess he's kind of low key, you know, so all the way over here. Yes, ma'am. Not really. You know, I mean, I had already written 7 books, you know, by the time, you know, that Hollywood got a hold of me, like it. And so I was pretty structured, you know, in what it is that I wanted to do and how I wanted to do it. Like that. And I kind of enjoy the fact that, you know, that the TV show and the books have two different trajectories, you know, and two different patterns like that. Because I think, you know, if they were slavishly, you know, similar, the painful part of that would be there would be no reason to read the books or there would be no reason to watch the TV show. And so I'm kind of, you know, happy with the fact that, you know, that they tend to go in different directions and have different things happen. You know, most of the characters that are in my books are all based off of, you know, friends and family and neighbors and all of that. And they're much stronger in my head, you know, than actors probably ever would be. My father is Lucian. You know, my dad is Lucian. I don't ever have to look for that voice ever. You know, I hear it all the time. Like, and so, you know, it's really kind of nice to have that, you know, that immediacy, you know, with those characters and to hear those voices, you know, I'm hearing voices, it's bad. You know, and be able to incorporate them as the characters a lot easier that way. I mean, one of my favorite quotes is Wallace Stegner's quote on teaching and writing fiction, where he said the biggest piece of fiction ever written is that disclaimer that's at the beginning of every book that says nobody in this book is based off of anybody alive or dead. You know, that's not true. You know, I mean, you use everybody you know you run into. I got to tell you. So, yes, ma'am.
Do you
Oh, no. You two are together, aren't you? You two are together. You're going to double team me here. Okay. Right, right. Yeah, the only problem with it, we were talking about that, my wife and I, and my wife's remark was, if they ever actually did Vic the way Vic is in the book, it would have to be on Cinemax at like 3 o'clock in the morning, you know? Because, boy, she's got a mouth on her, like, you know? And I, in all honesty, like that, they discussed that a great deal. And I think they're going to loosen it up a little, just a little like that. But it's another one of those things where, you know, at its peak, Longmire's pulling in like 6 million people a night. And it's one of the top trending shows on Netflix now with season 1, 2, and 3. So it's another one of those things where they're like, you know, maybe we shouldn't monkey with this a whole lot, you know? And so I think that it's not going to change a great deal other than it's going to get a lot longer, which, you know, I'm in favor of. Like, and so I don't have any problem with that. So, somebody in the back? Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. With the extra time, will there be some of the spiritual visions that Walt has in the books that I haven't seen on the TV show?
Maybe not as detailed as in the books, but there is a lot more Indian interaction like that within the next season. There's a lot. And there's a lot more Henry. There's a lot more Lou Diamond Phillips, like at which he's really happy about. Like, and so, you know, yeah, there will be some changes like that. And I think it gives them an opportunity so much more to accomplish that simply because they do have some more time. I mean, when you're limited to that 42 minutes, you have to stay with the procedural aspects of a plot so strongly. Like, in Brand X, you know, they really felt like every episode had to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, you know? And, you know, Netflix is like, well, we don't know. Yeah, so, whatever. Yeah. You know, they're great, you know, and you know, what's going to happen next year is going to, and suddenly Longmire becomes the longest running television show of all time, not chronologically, but just simply the longest, you know, episodes of all time. Like, and so, but yeah. So it gives them a little more freedom to accomplish maybe a little bit more of the setting, you know, and place, you know, which I think is one of the strong suits, you know, of the books and of the television show too, like that, because, you know, so much of TV nowadays is that flash cut, jump cut, blue interior lighting, everything, and, you know, snappy dialogue and all this stuff, you know, and Longmire's a little different. It's a Western, you know, it lets the atmosphere breathe a little bit. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, ma'am. Yes, you. You know, it's interesting like that because an awful lot of the humor, I get that question a lot of times because a lot of times people ask me, they say, well, what's the, you know, biggest difference, you know, between your books, you know, and a lot of the other books that are out there in the crime fiction vein? There's a lot of humor in my books, like just simply because I don't seem to have any control over that, you know. And every time I try and get real serious, you know, I have like 14 funny things that happen, and I can't combat that. You know, I have to let it happen. And so, but one of the things that's kind of tough for them is that a lot of the humor that's in the books is Walt thinking. You know, Walt's, you know, perspective on things, you know, and Walt's thoughts on things are a lot of the humor that tends to be in the books, or, you know, this illegal stuff that we can't do unless it's Cinemax at like 3 a.m. But a lot of it's that, you know, and it's very difficult for them to do that unless they're going to try and do a narration, you know, with the books, like, rather with a TV show, like that. And so, there is a lot of humor that's in the TV show, but it's a little bit more subtle, like that, I think, you know, and a little bit, you know, thinner spread than it is in the books, you know. And so, once again, I'm hoping so. Like, I think there is, simply because they do have more time to focus on other things than just the crime of the week, you know, kind of deal. So, yes, sir. You know what? Like, I always like I try and if I have friends like at that know places like it, or you know, if I can, you know, have an opportunity to include them in books, you know, and that doesn't include that's not just people, that's also places. I'll do that too. Like, I always, you know, try and use literal places either I've been or that, you know, close friends like that have been or something like that. So yes, sir. You're not going to ask me if I've taken peyote, have you? Because that's bad enough I got all these Warner Brothers spies out here in the audience. Now I got to deal with the DEA, too?
My other favorite scene was when Virgil with the headdress helped him on top of the mountain.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to ask you if we're going to see Virgil again. And then experiences like that.
So he kind of sidled out of it and then turned around and came back in there again, didn't he? I can neither confirm nor deny any suspicions that you might have. I get about my experiences, you know, with, you know, for me, like the spiritual part of the books is, you know, is really kind of essential. Like that simply because I spend a lot of time, you know, up there on the res with my buddies up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation like that. And one of the things I'm acutely aware of, you know, whenever I'm hanging out with my buddies up there is that, you know, my kind of people have only been in this part of the world for a couple of hundred years. And, you know, my buddy Marcus Red Thunder, his folks have been here for thousands. You know, and so it's quite possible, you know, that maybe they know a little bit more about, you know, what's going on around us than maybe we do. And I think that there's a simple reason for that, in that, you know, most of our modern society is all built around making us go faster and faster, whereas the Indian philosophies are more of slowing down, of noticing things like that. And that kind of dovetails a little bit with Walt's investigative skills, I think, you know. And so for me, that will continue to be a strong suit, you know, within the books. It's a little tougher for them, you know, on the TV show like that, but yeah, it'll continue to be a part of the books. No two ways about it. So all the way in the back. Yes, sir. Okay.
When I see you, I see more of the Walt Longmire that I imagine.
Oh, no, no. No. No, 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 no. No, my wife has the best answer about that. She says, "Craig, you know, Walt Longmire is who Craig would like to be in 10 years. It's just he's off to an incredibly slow start." And, And I can see your point like that, because I mean, in the books, you know, Walt's an offensive tackle for USC like that. I mean, he's a refrigerator with a head, you know, and Robert Taylor, he's got more of a quarterback's build. He's about 6'3", a little over like that, you know, a little slim, you know. And so he has to be like that for all the stuff that they have him do, you know, on the TV show and stuff. But yeah, Walt's more, you know, like, I mean, come on, 260 pounds and close to 6'5". He's a moose is what he is. And so, you know, one of the things I enjoy is the fact that, like, you know, he's not able to, you know, get up and run for 5 miles. You know, he's not capable of doing that kind of foolishness. You know, he's, you know, a long time ago, he came to the conclusion he was built more for fight than flight, you know. And so, you know, and the character is fun for me like that, because, you know, you've hit upon one of the key images, you know, for me, or one of the key issues like that I have as an advantage over Hollywood. Hollywood, you know, with their millions of dollars, you know, and all of the things that they've got, all these magical, you know, abilities that they've got, you know, but they kind of have to commit, you know, they have to do things. They have to cast, you know, actors in the roles. They have to commit, you know, to, you know, wardrobe. They have to commit to sets. They have to commit to settings, you know, all these different things. And, you know, I don't have to do that. You know, I really don't like that, you know, because I've got this one incredible, you know, secret weapon. It's called your imagination. And all I have to do is just knock over those first dominoes of your imagination and let that do all my work for me. Until Robert Taylor came along, you could have come down here and had a courtroom artist go around and have everybody in this room describe what they thought Walt Longmire looked like, and not a single one of them would look the same. And that's the wonderful thing about a book, you know, which is, of course, why we're here today in this lovely bookstore. So somebody else had their hand up. I think I already called on you once. Yes, ma'am.
You talked in the past that you have some other stories about some of the other characters.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, but the horse races, that, you know, that's all completely Walt stories is what that is. You know, I've got another couple of, like, novels that I've worked on, some things I'm getting going like that that are, you know, completely different, you know, other things like that that don't have anything to do with Walt. And but I got to admit that, you know, Walt is just really good company, you know. I'm having a hard time yanking away from him just because I really enjoy his company. He's fun to be around, you know, I have to admit. And so I've got to find time, like, at a way, you know, every once in a while to do some other stuff. Like, one of the things I really enjoyed doing was that little novella, Spirit of Steamboat, like that. I really enjoyed doing that. That was a fun one to do. And and I've got some other ideas like that I don't think are all full-fledged, you know, novel ideas with Walt, like that are a little bit shorter, like that you know, might be fun to play with. I'll get to them eventually, like that. And once I get off tour here for like 52 events like that, I'll be back, you know, back at it again. Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. And it's shaped a lot of his experiences, like in the Moccasins book, has shaped a lot of his how he deals
You know, they haven't made a decision on that, but I did give them a scenario, because one of the difficulties that they had was is that they made Walt and Henry, you know, 10 years younger than they are in the books. Like, and that was the first big, you know, altercation that I had with the producers, because they told me, they said, you know, we're thinking about making Walt and Henry about 10 years younger than they are in the books. And I had the immediate, you know, redneck cowboy author response where I was like, well, now why are we doing that? And their response was, well, because we'd like this show to run for about 10 years and we'd rather not have Walt and Henry on walkers, you know, by the time we get to the end, you know. And so I had a hard time arguing with that one, you know. And so, but, you know, even with that, you know, I you know, when we did the first pilot like that, one of the things I came up with, do you remember the truck bombing in Beirut? You know, where it was the largest number of Marines ever killed, you know, outside of the Tet Offensive back in the 80s. Like, and I was thinking that, you know, you could utilize that as Walt's, you know, military background, and Henry's too. Like that. And so anyway, that was another opportunity that, you know, whether they use that or not, we'll see. You know, it's according to whether they come up, you know, with a storyline that, you know, that we need that information, then we'll find out like that. But I sure watched the way he moves on the show, and, you know, for him to be carrying, still carrying that old 1911 45, like that, where'd he pick that one up first? You know, it kind of gives you a few indications right off the bat. And he seems awfully knowledgeable about military practice. So somebody else? Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. Yes. You make it sound like I've written too many, you know. I'm pretty good at keeping it in my head, you know, because it's kind of like, you know, how do you remember all the stories about your family, you know, and all the histories of your family? But I do have one secret weapon. It's called George Guidel's audio book versions of my books. You know, if I'm doing a book that kind of harkens back to one of my earlier books, one of the things that's really great is I can take those CDs, you know, and I'm driving down to Denver, and it's going to take me about 6 hours. Like, I can listen, you know, to a book practically, you know, on the way down. Like, and it's, you know, he's pretty easy on the ear. He does a pretty wonderful job with it. Like that. And so I can usually give myself a little booster shot whenever I need one, like that, and listen to George read one of my books. Of course, the torture of that is all I do is rewrite the book the whole time he's reading it to me. So, you know, so it's kind of a double-edged sword there as far as that's concerned there. Yes, Carmen. Hey.
You seem to be such good friends with the actors. Can you tell us about that?
Well, they drink, and so do I. And you know, that kind of lubrication, you know, works pretty well in just about any social situation. But actually, they're just really incredible people. I mean, I've really, you know, I mean, I know you guys are probably sick of hearing this like that, but you've probably also read and heard all the horror stories that a lot of authors have, you know, whenever they had their dealings with Hollywood. You know, and I think they're, you know, both sides are to blame for that. You know, a lot of authors are a little bit unrealistic about, you know, their expectations, you know, that Hollywood's going to bring to the game. And then also, you know, and I still stand by it, like that. The thing about the motion picture industry is that it makes the publishing industry look legitimate. And so, you know, there's some bad on both sides. Like that. And so I'm just really outrageously fortunate, like that the people that I'm working with are just really good eggs. They really are. And, you know, I mean, the example that I always use is, I mean, all these cast members all come up to Buffalo, for gosh sakes, you know, for Longmire days, because they just really like to come up. You know, they pretend like they're in Wyoming for 4 months in New Mexico, look at, and then finally get a chance to go to Wyoming, and, you know, and they just really enjoy it. And one of the examples that I always use is that I had the opportunity to write the commencement speech for the Northern Cheyenne High School, and I wrote that speech, look at, and then they told me when the date was, it was supposed to be delivered, and I was on a book tour, I wasn't going to be able to deliver it, and so they were disappointed, I was disappointed, you know. And so maybe 2-3 weeks later, I was down on the set, and Lou comes up to me, Lou Diamond Phillips, like, comes up, and first thing he always asks is, he always says, you know, well, what's going on the res? And I said, well, I wrote the commencement speech for Lame Deer High School, but I'm not going to be able to deliver it. He didn't even pause. He said, when is it? Like, 3 weeks later, he flew up to Billings, jumped in a rental car, and drove down to Lame Deer and delivered the speech for me. It was the largest crowd they've ever had at a commencement speech at Lame Deer High School. On a more serious note, there were like 3 students that were going to drop out like that because they were having domestic problems at home, and they stayed in because they knew that Lou was going to be delivering that speech and got their documents. So, Yeah. I told Lou, I said, you know, you did La Bamba in that. You can quit now, you know. So. So. Yes, ma'am. I did. Well, you know, my dad would argue about that. You know, my dad says I come from a long line of bullshitters. I'm just the first one to be smart enough to write them down, you know. But so. I got a brother, but he's not as good looking or smart as I am like that. But, you know, I can say that because he's not here today like that. So, no, he's a good guy. Like, I'm always, you know, if he had decided to become a writer, he would have been a better writer than I am, to be honest. So. Older, 8 years older than me. Yeah, I was a big mistake in oh so many ways, you know, and a dreadful disappointment in others, you know. So, what are you going to do, right? Anybody else? Have I talked you out here? I'm sorry.
No, I just wondered, in the past year, you know, with the TV series going away and then coming back, you became more and more of a well-known household name.
Boy, not in our house. I don't know. I'm going to come over to your house from now on, if that's okay.
I was reading a book, and there in the Vampire's General Store, they bought a Craig Johnson. Okay. And what I'm wondering is, with all of that face notoriety coming your way, how has that impacted you?
Not one darn bit. I mean, there's a certain insulation, insulatory quality that comes from being living in U Cross, Wyoming. And it's like whenever Longmire started up, and they had that, oh, we've got billboards, and we've got buses, and we've got this, and we've got that. I was like, I haven't seen a damn thing. Okay, you know. So, but I don't know. I mean, that's kind of, you know, you know, my life hasn't changed very much at all like that, you know, but then again, I really wouldn't want it to. Like, I'm really kind of happy with my life the way it is. You know, every once in a while, well, actually, one of the funny things that happened was, like, when we had the first Longmire days, you know, it was really kind of a low-impact event because it was me sitting in front of the Busy Bee on a card table signing books. You know, I think 20 people showed up. Like, but I was there, like, and I was carrying books in, like, and I carried books in and sat them on the bench in front of the Busy Bee, and there was a cowboy sitting there. This old guy, like it, and he looks up, like it, and he says, "Carrying in books in for that writer?" Like it, and I said, "Well, yeah, I am." And he goes, "He don't live here anymore." And I said, "What?" Like it, and he goes, "Oh yeah, once he got that TV show, like it, and all that stuff, like it, he moved over to Jackson. That's where he lives now." Like it, and I was like, "Really?" And he goes, "Yeah, yeah." Like it, and I said, "Well, okay." Like it, you know. So I carried all the books in, like it, and he got up, moved on down the road there, like it. But he had a book with him, like it. So evidently, he thought that, you know, the Craig Johnson was going to be there. And so, you know, I set up at the little card table, like it. Maybe about 40 minutes later, he comes. You know, he's in the back of the line, and he sees me. He tries to dart away, like it. And I was like, "Oh no, come here." And so. So, yeah, my life hadn't really changed all that much, you know. I mean, but I'm married to Judy Johnson, who makes sure I stay right on the ground all the time. Like, and so, you know, I wouldn't change it. It's a good life. So, yes. No, she didn't get to visit the set like that, but she spent a lot of time at the ranch like that, and I think that was probably more important to her than anything else like that. She was pretty brave like that. She'd get out and go on her own like that and do what she wanted to do like that. She was 14 when she got married. My father was 17, my mother was 14, and they ran away to Detroit. You know, only a 17-year-old would think that was romantic, you know. And my dad actually, I'm not going to tell you which car company it was, like, but they were hiring, like, and they had like three positions on the assembly line, and they had like about 800 guys show up, you know, the morning, you know, that they were going to try and like hire these three guys. My dad was, you know, in the middle of the line there somewhere, and he comes in, and they said, you know, well, do you know how to weld? My dad said, yeah, I do. And they asked him about all these different types of welding. He said, yeah, I can do that. Yeah, I can do that. I can do all that. And he said, well, okay, being here tomorrow, like at 7 a.m., like at first thing he did was go to the Detroit Public Library and check out every book they had on welding. Okay, and so if you had a 1943 or 1953 vehicle that fell apart, my father probably put it together. Okay, and so just so you know, like that. So somebody else had their hand up. We probably should wrap it up here. Like that, and I should just let one. Yes, ma'am.
Uh huh.
You know, a lot of times, you know, they're one of my favorite writers, Charles Dickens, you know, he had a really wonderful ability to come up with the names for characters that sounded like, you know, what they were or who they were. And when I was coming up with the name of Longmire, like at the first thing, you know, whenever you're coming up with a name for a any kind of a Western character, if you can stick it before a steakhouse, you know, then that's a good name. Like, I'm just joking. That was a joke part. Like, but the true part is that, you know, I thought about this guy, like, and he was going to be a little bit different from the usual protagonist, you know, in crime fiction, because Walt's what I tend to refer to as over. He's overweight. He's overage. He's overly depressed, you know. And since, like, one of the seminal issues that had the biggest effect on him psychologically was the death of his wife, and he's been trying to get over it, you know, for 5 years, like, when we first meet him, I thought Longmire, you know, that will work, like, that, you know, he will be, you know, because he's been depressed for such a long period of time. I thought that would work. So I utilize a lot of those kind of Dickensian phrasings. And then I'm always looking for names. You know, whenever I'm signing people's books, you know, I'm always like, oh, that's a good name. I haven't used that one in a long time. Like, and so that's always fun. And then, but I guess that I should probably close it up here and sign some books for you guys. But I always give you guys a little bit of a preview as to what the next book is actually going to be about. The next book is actually called The 1% Solution, is the working title, like that. And the reason it's called The 1% Solution is because it's kind of a combination of Sherlock Holmes, The 7% Solution, and also the outlaw bikers who are referred to as the 1%ers by the American Motorcycle Association after the Hollister rallies and riots, like at, you know, subsequent riots, like at, in 1948, I think it was, 47 or 48. Anyway, what happens is, Walt and Henry actually make their way over to Hewlett, Wyoming. Population 396. And it's kind of like our version of Sturgis, which you might have heard of. This is the 75th anniversary year for Sturgis. They're expecting over 1 million bikers this year. Well, the spill-off from that is going to end up in Hewlett. And Walt and Henry make a little run over there, like that. And Henry's actually been doing the Jack Pine Gypsies hill climb race ever since 1970, when he came back from Vietnam. And so they go back over there for that race. But one of the big excitements that happens is we finally get to meet Lola. The Lola, that the 59 T-Bird convertible is named for. And so that will be an interesting book for all of you, I'm sure. Like that. So thank you so much for being here tonight.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.